All right, Rick Tittle with you coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. I highly recommend checking out Untold because they do a great series when it comes to sports documentaries. And one that I saw on Netflix, this is really great, was entitled Chessmates. And joining us right now, we're happy to have him, is the grandmaster and one of the main protagonists of that documentary, Hans Niemann. Hans, welcome to the show. And first of all, I'm of Danish heritage, and I saw you are too. So I guess we Danes, there's not a lot of us. We got to stick together, right?
Yeah, it's quite distant, mainly sort of Danish German, but Denmark is a great country. I've had the opportunity of visiting, but.
So I'm from the East Bay, and I saw that you spent some time in Orinda. How long were you out there in Contra Costa County?
Well, I was born in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And at the age of 2, I moved to Laguna Beach until the age of 7, when I moved to the Netherlands for 2 years, and then I did live in Orinda for about a year and a half, 2 years. I was a big water polo player, as most people in that area were.
Mm-hmm.
So I miss those days.
So what was your time like in the Netherlands? Was that a blink, or did it kind of stay with you and shape you in any way?
Well, that was the beginning of my chess career, actually. Mm. I learned how to play chess in school. So living in the Netherlands was a lot different than America. I mean, everyone kind of bikes everywhere, you have a lot more freedom as a kid. I personally loved living there, so it was certainly a formative experience, especially getting introduced to the game of chess.
Now, when I was a kid in the 70s, you know, we didn't have all these amazing entertainment opportunities of video games and Netflix and such things in the house, so we played a lot of chess, and, you know, this is like, I don't know, 1977, I'm beating all my brothers, all my friends, and then once I started competing, I realized I was garbage. I just... not that good after all. When did you realize, how old were you when you found out that you weren't just good, but that you were really, really good?
You know, there are probably different stages of that, because when you're young and naive, you have that realization that, oh, you know, you're so good. But then as you progress and you travel and you play, you know, different tournaments, you kind of realize how much farther things go. I would say that at the end of the first year of playing chess, I had become the best in my school. So at that stage, I understood that I had, you know, a degree of talent. However, once I moved back to the Bay Area, specifically Orinda, as you mentioned, and, you know, I rapidly rose from being 1,000 rated to 2,000 one year, and then 2,200 the next year, and then I was the youngest to win the Tuesday night marathon at the Mechanics Chess Club, which is one of the oldest chess clubs in America. That was kind of the moment, I would say, around maybe 11 or 12 years old. I was ranked the number 3 chess player under 12 for my age group. So I guess at that stage was, you know, I had seen myself as a prodigy. But only really until the age of, 18, when I broke into the, 18, 19, when I became a top 100 player of the world, did the concept of being a chess professional become truly realistic.
It's amazing to me to think that you're barely old enough to buy a drink. You're 22, and you have lived this amazing life so far. You grew up very quickly, and if you think about moving to New York by yourself when you're 16, what was it like playing those, I guess maybe it's Washington Square Park, but those OGs, those outdoor chess players? And I'm sure they were like, who the hell is this little punk? And then they took you in, and now they're all proud of you. What were those days like?
Yeah, I mean, some of that was obviously, dramatized. But I have been going to that park for a very long time, and I enjoyed playing the Hustlers. Around the age of 12 or 13, it was obviously more competitive, and I would give them odds to make it, you know, more interesting. But from my perspective, I always enjoyed visiting them in the park, because it was the purest embodiment of passion for the game. And obviously, as you compete, more stress comes into play. There's financial things in play. So obviously just playing chess in the park, and most of these people have spent their entire lives there, you know, not to receive such great financial, success. So I find that level of passion that is void of sort of stress and the typical downsides of high-level competition to be something that is a great reminder of why I initially started playing chess in the first place. Obviously, the segments of the documentary which show them speaking about me were quite funny and inspiring to watch. So, you know, it's those parts, you know, have been formative for a lot of chess players. I mean, especially in Bobby Fischer's time, mm-hmm. he was a frequent guest of the parks, you know, Union Square and Washington Square Park. So I think, every I guess in basketball you have a similar thing with pickup games. So I suppose it's an experience everyone has from a young age and forms their character in some way or another.
Rick Tiller with Hans Niemann from Chessmates on Netflix. I've interviewed chess players in the past, and one of my faves is Zarina Crush. She's always very charming. But I also had Daniel Nadaritsky when he won the championship at 18, and I was very sad to see him die at such a young age. And some people said that it was just really the stress that got to his heart. Was that in any way cautionary for you to, you know, to avoid that type of stress, or does that have nothing to do with you?
You know, obviously I remain, you know, conscious of you know, things that can go wrong or the consequences or side effects of being in the public eye, especially being under scrutiny. You know, I'm very aware, you know, you see a lot of Hollywood stars or people who may be experienced at different degrees, you know, who have issues. So it's something that I'm obviously aware of, but the main thing that you try to just remain focused and away from distractions. And the travel schedule is so intense that even now, you know, I flew 11 hours from Paris to LA. I'm completely jet lagged. So you're kind of just trying to make it through it, maintaining energy, maintaining some degree of focus. But yeah, I mean, chess can have a have a toll on the mind and the body. So, you know, it's important to try to find some balance.
So in the documentary, when you do play the Norwegian world champ, Magnus Carlsen, you win, and afterwards he's all upset. He said, I had no chance, and you had to have been cheating. The question I have, and of course we won't get into some of the theories, how do you cheat over the board? Like, I know you had some missteps in the early days of chess.com, but I don't understand how you could possibly cheat over the board. And I know that you sued them and there ended up being a settlement, but what were some of the things where Magnus was like, I had no chance in that match?
Well, you know, that's maybe how he felt sort of from a purely emotional perspective, but from a factual statistical perspective, that game was actually sort of one of the worst games he had played in the past few years. And that was actually really far from my best game, even in that tournament. That was the third round of the tournament. In the first round, I played a very high-level game, high-accuracy game. When you play, you know, some people's main metric for measuring how well you played is comparing, you know, the accuracy of your moves to the computer. And, you know, my relative accuracy in comparison to my previous games is actually quite low. It was honestly a case of him getting in his own head and that leading him to play worse. To be honest, the game itself, you know, although I'd like to say how impressive it was, from the game itself really wasn't that impressive. My psychological resilience and ambition was certainly unique and is what probably left him very psychologically uneasy, because he was not used to someone so young and so new to that level of, you know, pressure to be so calm. But yet, you know, the boring truth about it is that it was more so a self-imposed loss from his side, and solid execution from mine, rather than some feat of genius.
Very interesting. You know, a lot of times in sports, when a champion comes in young, if they don't fit in with the traditional decorum, people are upset. Like, I think about Muhammad Ali, who came in and talked about how great he was, and John McEnroe screaming at the refs, and everyone's like, oh, but
oh, yeah, even Djokovic, you know,
yeah,
you know, was
right.
Welcome so much.
But my point is, you, from the very beginning, were like, you know, suck on that, you know, blah, blah, blah. You were like, yes, yes. And then some people are like, that you're not supposed to do that in chess.
Well, one counter, you know, just one contextual thing to understand. For the Singfield Cup, I was the brand ambassador of the Play Magnus Group. Mm. And me and Magnus, you know, we're brand ambassadors of the same company, virtually his company. So this narrative that, you know, I actually was embraced by the chess world before this. I received many wildcard invitations before the Singfield Cup. I was invited to Miami, giving, like, this was a great wildcard opportunity. So, you know, I will say that at that point, yes, I was vocal, I was interesting, but that was honestly to my benefit, and led me getting a lot of opportunities, a lot of sponsorships that gave me the upper hand. You know, from when I first became, you know, from 2021 and onwards, or 2022 respectively, I received so many opportunities, which only accelerated my growth. So I would say that in chess, I don't think that people are so averse or unwelcoming to unique stars. I just think that it was more so that the aftermath led them to having to find excuses to sort of ostracize and blacklist me. And my sort of honest and brash character was an easy excuse for them to use.
Yeah, and just getting back to that match in 2022 with Carlsen, the fact that it's not possible for him to have a bad game, it's not possible for him to choke, and those chess.com guys who I thought came off very smug in that documentary, but those chess.com guys are like, we're going to prove it. We have the algorithms. We have the ways of proving that Hans did cheat over the board, and at the end of the day, they threw their hands up, and they were like, he didn't cheat. And so the thing is, though, in our society, you give someone a scarlet letter, and even when they're exonerated, it carries with you. And so,
absolutely. I mean, people truly underestimate the damage of and the blemish that leaves on someone for their entire life. And the fact that they felt so emboldened to make such speculative accusations that they knew would leave such a, you know, a mark, you know, is a reflection of their lack of character and sort of a godlike complex and mafia style ways.
The other thing is, too, as you were mentioning, you have done more for that sport than, I mean, Magnus Carlsen, yes, one of the greatest players of all time, but personally, and I hate saying this, but he's a dud, you know? And so this is why people are drawn to a champion like you that's actually intriguing. So you'd think they would be thanking you. And I know the chess.com guys at first were like, oh, we're going to do everything we can to help you. And then they turned on you and then they came back. But do you think you get the credit for taking a game that, for a lot of people, was dying out, and now it's just booming?
Well, you know, the thing is that I actually try to push the boundaries of chess, in terms of bringing chess to a unique market in a lot of ways. You know, I have organized a lot of one-on-one matches. I've tried to make chess more interesting, tried to bring rivalries. I've actually pioneered a lot of different formats that people have started using. The game of chess really, really is in need of a revolution and is in need of becoming a developed, modern sport. I think it has huge potential. You know, so to me, obviously, this Netflix documentary and Untold and all the things, you know, obviously, I don't think that having the game being associated with something so negative is good. You know, obviously, you see in the modern world now, people can use negative publicity to create, you know, careers. I mean, there's a saying, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I obviously don't believe in that, but it's not, you know, it's not an entirely stupid thing to say. So, you know, I do hope that, you know, Netflix and other eventually big brands and bring companies that that can provide the necessary sort of financial ecosystem behind growing a sport, become interested in the game. And I think it's a game that embodies much more than just a sport, just a board game. It has history. It is a reflection of life. You know, it's a game that is beyond, you know, time. It's something that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. It's something that has been relevant in politics. You know, it's become a reflection of a nation's intellectual capacity. It's something that, you know, certain presidents and nations regard as a representation of their countries. I mean, it's more than just a game, and I personally believe it's only a matter of time before that level of prestige and recognition comes on a global scale, and I hope to be, you know, supportive of the game and involved in that path.
Well, I was thinking, you know, before you, I remember a Letterman used to have Garry Kasparov on his show, and he was funny and charming and humble, and this is at a time when the Cold War was ending and Russia was supposed to be, you know, the enemy, and here's this, like, very erudite, continental, sophisticated guy who was very, I found Garry Kasparov very likable. And so it just made me think stylistically, did you study Kasparov and how he went about things, and did he have a certain style the way he attacked, or would he mix it up?
I would say that from a personality level and inspiration, I would say that Fischer has been really, honestly, my greatest inspiration. Mm-hmm. His style and his mindset, and obviously the way that he overcame the Soviets in the Cold War, I took inspiration from how I had to overcome what I call the chess mafia. So, obviously Kasparov himself has been incredibly inspirational. You know, funnily enough, that suit that I wore in the cathedral where I was mainly doing the interview, I got that from the same tailor that Kasparov gets his suits from. And it was actually by pure coincidence. I was walking on the Upper West Side. I walked into a store. I knew he lived in the neighborhood. I walked into the store. I mentioned I was a chess player. I said, "Well, there's a famous chess player who gets all of his suits from here." And he made me guess eventually to Kasparov. And after he told me that, I had to get my suit. So that was a funny coincidence. But Kasparov's a great chess player. I mean, he's a legend of the game. I read his book, How Life Imitates Chess. You know, how your personal life and how your emotions are a reflection of yourself on the chessboard. So that has made me certainly more conscientious of my daily habits and how that reflects, you know, on the chessboard and all aspects of my life. So it certainly made me a lot more introspective. And you know, he was incredibly disciplined. He had an entire ecosystem, a team around him. It was a true sort of machine. And you see that now in most sports, right? You know, LeBron has a nutritionist. He has an entire legion, you know, behind him. So you know, once you kind of understand that sports is not just about the actual game itself, and that you have to find the edge in every instance, whether it's your diet, your sleep, your training regimen. So you know, that's one thing I personally was inspired by Kasparov.
Last question for you, Hans, and the fly lid, as we say in Oakland, the hair. And I almost thought, like, when your hair was hanging over your face, and of course a lot of young guys wear it like that, but I almost felt like it's like a poker face, or maybe a closer in baseball. It was like almost an intimidating thing. Like, where am I looking? Am I looking at the board? Am I, you know, because you will stare people down. Was that intentional, or was it just like, I woke up and my hair was like that?
I think that I've never been much of the type to take care of my hair too much. I sometimes forget to get a haircut months on end, so I wouldn't say that I'm the most well groomed chess player, but I'm working on it.
Very good. So what's next for you? You're 22. I mean, chess grandmaster, teaching more, endorsements, traveling the world. Do you have a busy schedule, or are you taking a little time off?
Yeah, I'm competing a lot. I mean, I just had a great match in Paris. I'm now the number 12 player in the world. Mm. I tied for second to the World Championship last December in Qatar. So I'm on the right direction. I'm just sort of, you know, working hard, trying to break through and win a title. So, you know, that's really where all my, you know, my energy is being put, and I'm trying to stay focused and disciplined, and doing some interviews, but, you know, trying to stay focused on letting the show speak for itself.
It's Hans Niemann. He's part of the amazing Chessmates, part of the Untold sports documentary series on Netflix. It's available right now. I highly recommend watching it. And Hans, look, there are a lot of different ways people can view that thing. I'm on your side, and it's not just because we're both Bay Area kids. I found myself, you really were the victim in that. And so best of luck with all that. And then hopefully down the road we'll catch up again, man.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.